Hello, I'm Yogi Yakal. This is number 0573, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0573. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, it's all about the science. Theoretical astrophysicist Dr. Katie Mack is the author of The End of Everything. She looks at how our universe will end. It's okay. You don't have to make any quick plans.
For the most part, we are talking about trillions and trillions and trillions of years in the future, so far that we don't even have good words to describe those time frames. But there are a couple possibilities that could be just tens of billions or hundreds of billions of years away, which, again, is a long time, but not necessarily cosmically speaking. And one of the possibilities I discussed, vacuum decay, could technically happen at any moment, but we think it probably can't, and even if it could, it would probably be a very, very, very long time from now.
Mark Hartzman is the author of The Big Book of Mars, From Ancient Egypt to the Martian, a deep space dive into our obsession with the red planet.
I was looking to write something about Tesla and his attempts to contact Mars, or his beliefs he was contacted by Martians. I'd heard about this somewhere along the line and thought, well, let me dig into that and see if I can find a quick story to write up. And as I started researching that through some newspaper archives, I came across instead a very different story about a man in the 1920s. His name was Dr. Hugh Mansfield Robinson. He was a lawyer in London. And the article was saying that he was telepathically in communication with a Martian woman whose name was Umaruru.
Oh, there's a lot more to that story. Science writer Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy on the SpaceX splashdown and the Mars mission, which will have its own helicopter.
It's like a souped-up, on steroids, drone type of helicopter. It's purely a technology demonstration. Its name is Ingenuity. Really, the aim here is to prove that you can have a flying vehicle operate in Mars's atmosphere, which is really 1/100th as thick as Earth's. And it weighs less than 2 kilograms, and it's on the underbelly of the rover. They're going to conduct all these amazing flying experiments, so I can hardly wait to see the camera footage coming from this helicopter technology.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0573, was Yogi Yakal, numerologist to the stars, and also a speaker, activist, and teacher. He was a regular feature on the old radio show I did, on a monthly basis, and always a fan favorite, and an all-around nice guy as well. Thank you very much, Yogi Yakal, or Aggie Akal Singh Khalsa, numerologist to the stars, or as I like to call him, Gus. You can check out his website, and you'll also find out more information about all the stuff that he does by going to the show that he just mentioned today, 0573, where you'll find the link. Again, see how it all comes back full circle? Yes. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An unnamed man in North Queensland, Australia, posted notices offering a $100 prize to the person able to best impersonate Chewbacca from Star Wars. But the contest turned out to be a hoax designed to harass the woman who dumped him. The posters listed the woman's phone number and invited contestants to call and deliver their best Chewbacca roar. The woman, identified only as Jessica, said, "I'm getting phone calls at really strange hours of the night. I thought it was quite funny, actually a good joke. However, she drew the line when the ex abandoned his car, without tires, in her driveway at her home, blocking her in." Said Jessica, "The police are going to have to do something about it." Well, harassment is harassment, even if it involves a sense of humor. Things could have gone much worse, though. Reminds me of a creepy, low-budget film that I saw as a kid back in the 70s.
Paramount Pictures presents Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
Yeah, that film was more sad than creepy.
Jessica.
Pueblo, Colorado police were intrigued to find a young man sleeping in a car parked behind a motel on August the 2nd, since motels have rooms with beds that you can sleep in, said Captain Tom Rummel in a tweet. Upon running the car's license plate, he continued, the officers found it had been stolen in an armed carjacking, and there on the front seat was a sawed-off shotgun, just like the victim said was used. The sleepy thief, a juvenile, was taken into custody, and the car was returned to its owner. You know, I'll bet that's a teen whose parents always complain that he sleeps too much.
I'm Tom Baudet from Motel 6, and we'll leave the light on for you.
Would that be the hazard lights or the headlights? An Amazon delivery driver in Nottingham, England, is out of a job after 53-year-old Sharon Smith discovered him defecating in her back garden in late July. Smith said she saw the man run toward her garden and went to investigate. I asked what the heck he was doing, Smith said, and he just remained pooing whilst asking me what my problem was. The cheek of it. And by the way, she said cheek, I didn't. The driver told police he wasn't feeling well and was desperate and didn't realize he was in a private garden. Smith agreed to not press charges as long as he cleaned up the mess and his employer was informed. Amazon promised a gift voucher as a goodwill gesture. Are you wondering what value of Amazon gift card is appropriate for when your driver plays human fertilizer in a customer's garden? Oh, it better be big. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, I know this next story is sort of a man bites dog tale, but here we go. A 26-year-old man in Plymouth, England, was detained on July 9th after officers working nearby heard a commotion and looked up to see the man struggling with a seagull and biting it. Said a police spokesperson, he sunk his teeth into it before throwing it to the floor. The man told police the seagull had attacked him, trying to get his McDonald's meal, and also volunteered that he had been under the influence of drugs. Said police, the seagull was clearly injured by the incident but flew off before we were able to check on its welfare. The man was taken to a hospital for treatment. You know, this is one of the reasons why I've never been a believer in eating outdoors. I don't like to compete with flying critters for my food, nor do I relish the idea of flying critters leaving deposits in my food. I eat indoors. I know this is kind of tough in this pandemic age where some restaurants don't allow you to eat indoors. For instance, one McDonald's in my neighborhood has the drive-thru open, and you can social distance and order indoors, but you have to go to their outdoor seating area to dine. No, no, 1,000 times no. And quick question. If you're feeding McNuggets to a bird, are you encouraging cannibalism? Just asking for a friend. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We know that the universe started with the Big Bang, but how is it going to end? Dr. Katie Mack is a theoretical astrophysicist and the author of the book, The End of Everything. She joins us on the line from Massachusetts. Hi, Dr. Katie.
Hello, how are you doing?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us. With a title like this, I have to ask right off the bat, did you grow up as someone who thought the glass was half full or half empty?
I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I think I can appreciate both the emptiness and the fullness of the glass.
Okay. So you came up with this book, The End of Everything, which basically tells us how the world is going to end. And I understand you have five possible, shall we say, cosmic finales that can hit the Earth.
Well, it's not just the Earth, it's the universe as a whole. So
right.
we're pretty sure we know how the world is going to end. That's all more or less known physics, but the universe itself is the subject of a lot of speculation and some really interesting possibilities.
Now, I'm hoping that we're talking of a time frame that's way in the future, but are some of the possibilities closer than others?
Potentially, yeah. So for the most part, we are talking about, you know, trillions and trillions and trillions of years in the future, so far that we don't even have good words to describe those time frames. But there are a couple of possibilities that could be just tens of billions or hundreds of billions of years away, which, again, is a long time, but not necessarily cosmically speaking. And one of the possibilities I discuss, vacuum decay, could technically happen at any moment, but we think it probably can't, and even if it could, it would probably be a very, very, very long time from now.
Okay, before we have a lot of listeners perking up their ears and you're saying vacuum decay can happen any moment, let's just describe what that one is.
Sure. So that one's based on some recent discoveries in particle physics that suggest that there's a possibility that our universe is not entirely stable, and this possibility could lead to a kind of spontaneous creation of a bubble of a different kind of space somewhere in the universe, and that bubble would then expand throughout the cosmos and destroy everything in its path. Now, it's really not something we should worry about for a number of different reasons, one of them being that even though we can't predict when that might happen, the current calculations suggest that if it could happen, it would be, you know, something like 10 to the power of 100 years from now, so a very, very long time from now. And also, there's a lot we don't understand about particle physics that suggests that maybe it really can't happen at all, or maybe we'll learn something with new experiments or theories in the next several years that'll point us in a different direction. But it's a fun possibility to think about just because, in principle, it could be any time.
Boy, I think your idea of fun and some other people's idea of fun are two different things. Now, one of the things I understand is a possibility, and this is one that I can't say concerns me because I feel it's going to happen, like you say, way beyond any of us being around. But we have this constantly expanding universe, and I was always mm-hmm. under the impression that it couldn't necessarily expand forever.
Well, you know, there was a long time when scientists weren't sure if it would expand forever or if the universe would continue to expand for a while and then stop and then re-collapse. Whatever happens, though, it really is not going to just stay stable. So we know for sure that the universe is changing, is evolving, is expanding, and there's no possible future that we know about where everything just kind of stops now and is fine. Either it expands forever or it collapses, and I discuss both of those possibilities in my book, but neither of them really ends well. If it expands forever, then that means that all the galaxies in the universe are getting farther and farther apart. At some point, new stars stop forming, and you end up with a universe that's just colder and darker and emptier over time, and everything kind of decays into nothing. On the other hand, if it recollapses, then that brings galaxies and stars crashing into each other, and you end up with a universe that's hot and dense, just like it was in the very, very early universe, and nothing can live in that space.
Now, if it does indeed expand forever, does mm-hmm. that mean that over a period of time, for instance, our galaxy, our planets would be further from the sun and from each other than they are now?
So probably not. The standard picture of the future evolution of the cosmos says that the universe will expand forever, and the way that it'll happen is that distant galaxies will get far apart from each other, but within the same galaxy, our sun will stay in the Milky Way galaxy. The planets will continue to orbit the sun. That's not going to be affected by the expansion of the universe. So in that scenario, you know, our sun will die. It'll, you know, the planets will fall into the sun or whatever. All that will happen eventually, but the galaxy itself will not be torn apart. However, there is a possibility that I discuss in the book where there's a different kind of expansion, one driven by a strange version of what we call dark energy. In that case, it would be able to tear stars away from galaxies and planets away from their suns and so on.
Are there other ways that this world can end, or this universe, I should say, can end?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of interesting possibilities that have come up just in the last few years that hypothesize a kind of cycling model of cosmology. So one where you would have a cycle from a universe that begins with a big bang and then ends with perhaps a big crunch where everything collapses together again. And then that sparks a new big bang. And so you could have cycles of universe where there'd be the death of a universe and a new beginning of a new universe and so on over and over again. So that's a scenario I call a whole category of those possibilities the bounce. So some kind of bouncing cosmology that goes in cycles. And that would be an interesting possibility because in some of those hypotheses, you could have something that survives from one cycle to another, and some remnant of our universe could survive into the future.
Is there a possibility that our current existence from the Big Bang is actually part of a bounce then?
Yeah, it's definitely possible that that our cosmos could be the sort of next iteration of a previous universe, and there could be potentially traces you could find of previous universes in our cosmos, and there are some researchers who are looking for those kinds of signals now.
In studying the science and in writing the book, The End of Everything, it's a fascinating topic. But beyond the fascination of the could-bes and possibilities, is there actual science that we're learning? Is there things that we can take away from reading your book that speak to our current situation in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, so in the book, I talk about a lot of what we know right now in cosmology and physics and astronomy, and I talk about sort of what we understand about our current picture of the universe. And in that process, there's a lot of physics that I discuss, a lot of astrophysics, a lot of concepts that are really more universal about that touch on a lot of different areas of science. So I think that even if the end of the universe is not the part you're particularly interested, there are bits of science that you'll learn in this book that will be interesting and potentially useful for thinking about other topics.
And generally speaking, when you came up with the idea for this book, who were you looking at as your primary audience? And by that I mean, were you looking at school kids, college students, the general population who were just interested in science? What?
Yeah, this book is really for anybody who is curious about the universe and interested in science. I don't assume that you know any kind of physics or astrophysics going in. So I'll explain some pretty deep concepts, but in terms that I keep pretty accessible. So the idea is that if you're curious about the universe, if maybe you've thought a little bit about these ideas, but you don't know the background, you haven't dug deep into, you know, the physics of expanding universe and so on, you'll get some basic ideas of this, some basic background, and be able to really dig into those concepts a little more. And if you do know a lot of the science already, I put in a lot of sort of more recent results from research, and hopefully you'll learn something then too.
And of the possibilities, the end of the universe coming our way at some point, of the ones you mentioned, is there one that for you stands out as the most plausible to happen?
Yeah, so the one that generally speaking physicists consider to be the most likely is called the heat death, and that's where the universe is expanding and it keeps expanding forever, and the expansion keeps speeding up, and you end up with that sort of cold, dark, empty, lonely universe. And that's not the most exciting possibility, but based on just looking at the way the expansion is going now and how it looks like it'll continue into the future, that's the one that's sort of the natural best guess.
And while these things, all these various ideas, as you say, take, you know, literally millions of years, if not more, is there a beginning to it, to leading to the end, or are we all just working our way toward that end?
we're just part of, you know, we're somewhere in the evolution of the cosmos. You know, we're 13.8 billion years after the Big Bang, and we have some timeline that stretches into the future, but there's no sort of obvious transition to, okay, now the end times start. you know, it's a gradual process in all of these scenarios. In the case where the universe might at some point recollapse, then there would be signs that we would see things in the data that would tell us that the recollapse is beginning. So there are various places we can look for hints of what might be coming, but it's just part of the natural life cycle of a universe, basically, where things are going now.
So basically, to use a human analogy, it's not like someone at a particular age gets a chronic disease and you can then determine how much time he or she has left. It's more like a situation from the time that you're born, you're slowly dying. You just don't know when.
Sort of, yeah. But we don't know currently what the death of the universe looks like. And there are a lot of different possibilities. And so with those different possibilities, they would have different timescales associated with them, and there would be different processes that would happen that would do the destruction.
It's a fascinating topic. The book is called The End of Everything. Dr. Katie Mack, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Dr. Katie Mack, author of The End of Everything. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0573, and you'll find links to Katie's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Big Book of Mars, plus Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back on the program to talk about SpaceX's return and the Mars mission. And we also have an idiot of the day coming your way, so stick around for that here on the Stuff File program, a show that is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. You probably saw this story already in the news, but the gullibility factor really needs to be stressed here. In July, scores of high-profile Twitter accounts were hacked, giving the intruder the ability to tweet as those people. "I am giving back to the community," the messages said, purporting to be from people like Bill Gates, Joe Biden, Jeff Bezos, Mike Bloomberg, and Kanye West. "All Bitcoin sent to the address below will be sent back doubled. If you send $1,000, I will send you $2,000. Only doing this for 30 minutes. Enjoy." Incredibly, fans of the hacked people sent $180,000 worth of Bitcoins to the anonymous address. And of course, none were returned, let alone doubled. The mastermind of the hack has been arrested. Florida teenager Graham Ivan Clark. He, along with 22-year-old Nima Fazeli of Orlando and 22-year-old Mason Shepherd of the UK, were arrested. Clark is just 17 years old, a kid who apparently just graduated high school, said state attorney Andrew Warren, and he will be charged as an adult. A small part of me thinks that the pinheads who fell for this get-rich-quick scheme almost deserve what they got, but a bigger part of me hopes that 17-year-old Clark spends all of his productive years behind bars and electronically doesn't get so much as a Game Boy to pass the time away. Now, last week, David Hines of Miami, Florida, was upset after he was given a $100 citation for not wearing a mask in public. That infraction pales in comparison with other things he told the officer. He said the government, the Treasury, they gave $2 trillion for PPP loans for small businesses. 85% went to major corporations. Well, in a massive bit of karma, last week Hines was arrested by federal investigators. He allegedly fraudulently obtained a $4 million Paycheck Protection Program loan from the Small Business Administration. Instead of funding payroll, investigators allege Hines spent the PPP money on personal expenses at dating websites, luxury jewelry, and clothing retailers, and Miami Beach resorts. Hines also spent PPP funds to purchase a 2020 Lamborghini sports car for $318,497.53. I'm wondering if dealer prep is included. Anyway, he faces up to 30 years in prison. So, he now gets his wish, living off taxpayers for the rest of his life. Yeah. Santa Cruz County, California sheriff's deputies responded to a report of a man firing a gun. An update came in. The man had carjacked a Honda and was heading south on the coastal highway. Deputies spotted the car and gave chase at more than 100 miles per hour, but the driver wouldn't pull over. As they got to town in Santa Cruz, the deputies backed off for safety, and the local police spotted the car and watched the man drive over a cliff into the rocky surf below. Amazingly, the driver not only survived, he climbed back up the cliff where he was taken into custody at gunpoint. 56-year-old John Kenyenju of Portland, Oregon, was charged with felony carjacking, felony evading police, hit and run with damage, and unlawful weapon use. You know, while he's in jail, he should be forced to watch the ending of Thelma and Louise on a loop. On another note, I'm wondering if after this story, Honda has some new ideas for their commercials. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Pennsylvania man is in jail on felony charges after police say a woman found him in her home with her fedora in one hand and a sports drink from the refrigerator in the other. According to the Altoona police, 27-year-old Adam Zurch allegedly walked into the house, took a Powerade from the fridge, and drank some of it before he walked to an upstairs bedroom and took the hat. Police were called to the home about 4:30 p.m. after the woman found Zurch in a second-story bedroom. She said she was getting ready for work in another bedroom when she heard an unknown voice. When she walked into the bedroom, Zurch was standing, holding her fedora and the sports drink. He then asked if he could have the hat, and when she told him he couldn't and that he needed to leave, Zurch allegedly started to explain that he was drunk, and then he fell over. After a couple of minutes, the woman grabbed Zurch and pushed him out of the house, and in the process collected the hat and Powerade drink from him. Police found Zurch walking down the block and indicated that he was unintelligible when he spoke and had a hard time answering questions. All he wanted was that fedora. You know, in this day and age, especially with people suffering from grammar issues, the world seems to be filled with hat crimes. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? It would seem that every 5 years we get a visit from Mark Hartzman. Back in 2010, he was on the show talking about his book, God Made Me Do It. In 2015, he was on with the title, The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, a memoir. And now he's back with The Big Book of Mars, From Ancient Egypt to the Martian, a deep space dive into our obsession with the red planet. He joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
So, good to be back.
You have a very eclectic grouping of books that you do. How did you come up with this particular one, The Big Book of Mars?
Well, this one also has sort of a weird beginning for me. So I know Mars seems a little bit different than, you know, Cromwell's embalmed head and weird things that God told people to do. But this one started with me doing some research for a website I had started called weirdhistorian.com. And I was looking to write something about Tesla and his attempts to contact Mars, or his beliefs he was contacted by Martians. I'd heard about this somewhere along the line and thought, well, let me dig into that and see if I can find a quick story to write up. And as I started researching that through some newspaper archives, I came across instead a very different story about a man in the 1920s, 1926. His name was Dr. Hugh Mansfield Robinson. He was a lawyer in London. And the article was saying that he was telepathically in communication with a Martian woman whose name was Umaruru. And I saw this and thought, wow, this is an unusual story. So let me look a little bit more into it. And he described very much, you know, what he learned from Umaruru. She was about 7 feet tall. She had big ears. She had tall hair like Marge Simpson. And the men were taller, and it was a very peaceful society. They liked to be in their homes and drive their cars and drink their tea, kind of like us, but in a more peaceful overall way. And he was hoping to reach them through a telegram as opposed to just telepathy. So in 1926, Mars was in opposition to Earth, which means it's at its closest point in its orbit, so about 35 million miles away. And he thought he would work with the radio tower in London, which was the largest and most powerful in the world at that time. And so he worked with them to send a communication straight to Mars. He thought, okay, let's see if their scientists can receive it and send a message back to us. He paid the long distance rate that the post office had, which I think the post office enjoyed using the event to market their long distance rate, which I thought was kind of funny. They kind of comment on this in their notes and memos within the organization. And so, of course, they do this, you know, one evening, and we don't hear anything back. Newspapers report this all over the world. They were hoping that there would be some response from Mars, but, you know, unfortunately nothing. And rather than just assuming that maybe there weren't Martians there, Mansfield said that the scientists on Mars were laughing at us and our scientists for not having the skills and the knowledge to be able to receive their communications. So he was convinced that it was us, it wasn't them. And so he tried it again 2 years later, also had no luck. So as I was researching all this, I grew so fascinated. I had no idea these things were going on. And I learned about all the other scientists that were also investigating life on Mars, intelligent life on Mars, and believing that they were far more advanced than we were here on Earth. And so if that's the case, how do we receive their signals that they're probably sending to us? And how can we send them signals that they could see? And this was, you know, this guy in London was maybe, you know, seemed a little bit off, maybe, but we're talking about, you know, people like Nikola Tesla, who did think he got contacted by Mars in 1899 and spent decades trying to contact extraterrestrial life. Marconi thought he was contacted in 1920. You know, Harvard professors, Amherst professors, Johns Hopkins, I mean, really smart people were convinced that there was intelligent life on Mars.
Now, we're going back in a period of time when science wasn't as advanced as it currently is, so I'm just curious to know if you found stories like this that were more recent.
Well, you know, the belief that there could be life on Mars has kind of lasted past this era. Not necessarily to the point that some of these guys thought, you know, and they thought that, just really quick, they thought that life would be so much more advanced because they believed that Mars had cooled earlier because it's a smaller planet. Therefore, everything would have evolved earlier, started its evolution earlier. So they thought life would have evolved there as well and would just be in an advanced state. Now, since then, you know, once we were able to kind of see through science that there wasn't a huge society on Mars, you know, they had the first flyby of Mars in 1964 with Mariner 4. And at that point, it looked like it was just a dead planet. But then, you know, scientists like Carl Sagan still believed that there could be macroorganisms on Mars. He didn't believe it all had to be microorganisms. In fact, when Viking launched in the 70s, mid-1970s, Sagan wanted to have a camera and lighting system that was supposed to be on, you know, throughout the full day. And I think they cut the lights or something out of the budget. And he was disappointed because he was afraid that while those cameras were running, when it was dark, he was afraid in the morning they would see footsteps in front of the lander. And they would have missed what created them because they didn't have the light to see what kind of creature could go by. And he had his reasons for thinking that a larger being could survive within the Martian atmosphere. And that mission also, and I talked about this in the book, there were several different life detection experiments on the Viking lander, and one of them came back with positive results. And so I spoke with the two co-experimenters, and they believe to this day that their data proves the existence of life on Mars. So there is still thought that that something could be on the planet. Certainly they're looking for evidence of ancient life, with the rovers, but there could be something lurking beneath the surface. Once they get past all that cosmic radiation that's on the surface, they get down below where there's water. They've seen that there's water, and where there's water, there's the ingredient for life. So I find it really fascinating, and who knows what could still be found.
As with all of your books, or at least the ones we've talked about, there's a quirkiness to some of the things that are discussed and discovered through your research. In this particular book, The Big Book of Mars, what was the thing for you that was either the oddest or the biggest aha moment for you when you thought, oh, this has got to be in the book?
Well, certainly the Uluru story was a big one for me, because that kind of sparked my whole interest, and finding out all those crazy stories was just really fascinating. And what the thing I thought was really cool about it was, aside from just that this was going on 100 years ago that a lot of people aren't aware of, I also found it interesting that it kind of put the 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast by Orson Welles into a lot more perspective. I think a lot of people are aware of that. It's sort of an event that happened in American culture, that people panicked thinking that Martians had actually attacked Earth while he was doing his radio broadcast. But suddenly you realize that, because, you look back and it seems kind of silly that people would think that. When, they missed the announcement that it was a dramatization, they believed it. But when you realize that they've been reading headlines in, the New York Times, all these respected papers for decades, saying that there was intelligent life on Mars, you start to understand why they may have actually believed it. Now, in terms of another weird thing that you were asking about, you would think after people panicked across the nation because of this broadcast that it wouldn't happen again, but it did. It happened again 11 years later in Quito, Ecuador. And two radio DJs were looking to drum up some business or some publicity, I guess, for their station. And so they decided that they would do a dramatization of War of the Worlds. And they, like Welles, they localized it. So Welles localized it to America. These guys localized it to their town in Ecuador. And they had people impersonating, the mayor and various, priests in town. And so it was very localized. And it got to the point where people believed it so firmly that they were racing from their homes. The whole police department had gone out to try to help the neighboring town where they said the Martians had attacked. And once everyone found out what was going on, they banded together and they marched to the radio station and rioted, and they set the place on fire. And then the fire department couldn't get there because of the crowd, blocking the way, and 15 people died. So, 1949, Martians killed 15 people in Ecuador.
Wow. You always seem to find the unusual, which is why, your website says it all, weirdhistorian.com.
There's a lot of fascinating stories out there. It's really fun to share them. There's a lot in the book. I mean, the book isn't all just the weird stuff, too. It also gets into, the current rover missions and challenges to overcome to try to get a manned mission, to Mars. Or even to colonize, and what goes into that and what we'd have to figure out and solve to make that possible. And it's all really a fascinating, past, present, and future.
I also like to pat myself on the back, because we've gone through this entire conversation without me bringing up a certain doctor who's touting a drug right now that talks about aliens. I don't even want to discuss her, but I have a feeling when your book comes out in paperback in the second edition, you might find room for her.
She sounds like she might have a lot of material behind her.
Absolutely. The book is called The Big Book of Mars, From Ancient Egypt to the Martian, A Deep Space Dive into Our Obsession with the Red Planet. Mark, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars, From Ancient Egypt to the Martian, a deep space dive into our obsession with the red planet. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0573, and you'll find links to Mark's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
And there are a couple of big items to discuss when it comes to space exploration, from the return of the first SpaceX crew to the launch of a new mission to Mars. And to talk about it, Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy, is back. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. Hi, Andrew.
Hey there, Peter.
So, I'm sure you watched the SpaceX, well, I know you did because you mentioned that you had a watching party on Facebook.
Oh yeah, it was awesome. Had lots of people, thousands of people joining me. You could, you know, even though we were just on social, you could feel the excitement.
Now, I watched it, of course, as well. And I got to tell you, that 6 minutes of silence when they're coming back into that dead zone, that was a long 6 minutes for me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the nail biter, right? Because there's no communication at all. And then you hear, you know, mission control, you know, pinging the spacecraft, basically, you know, calling them and doing a comm check. You know, you could hear the guy in mission code on comm check, Dragon comm check. And you don't hear anything. And you're just waiting for that first signal to come back. So it was awesome to actually hear them, you know, right on the money. They got the, you know, communications got back and drogue shoots came out. You know, everyone's elated. You know, that's the first. Everything happened exactly as it should have.
And I remember during the launch several months ago now that it was discussed that the thing that Elon Musk was most worried about was the reentry. So to me, like, the launch wasn't the nail biter. It was the reentry because of the alleged fears of Elon Musk.
Yeah, I mean, he expressed it during one of the press conferences just after the launch that, you know, he's tossing and turning in bed at night thinking of, you know, what could go wrong. And, you know, people asked him, you know, journalists asked him, well, what really does worry you? And he says, well, going through the atmosphere back in reentry, he says it's kind of the design of the spacecraft, the shape of the spacecraft is a little bit different from others, may not be as aerodynamical, made as the previous ones have been made. And so he was worried that, you know, will the heat shield point be directed properly on reentry? And so I think that went over in his mind multiple times. And that was, you know, I was watching him, actually. It was interesting, Peter, because they were showing, I don't know if you saw this, but there were a lot of coverage from Mission Control at SpaceX headquarters back in California. And you could see Elon Musk was in the front row. You know, he had his mask on, obviously, but you could still recognize him. And, you know, he looked pretty jittery there. He wasn't that calm.
Now, there were seven possible splashdown sites. They landed at Pensacola. There were concerns about the tropical storm that was in the area. How did you feel, and what can be done in the future about not having all of those non-participating boats in the area?
Non-participating boats. Yeah, I like that. Well, yeah, that, and I know what you're referring to. It's all the folks, like general public, who were, by the way, told by the Coast Guard to stay out of that zone, out of the landing zone. And yet, despite that, there was a whole flotilla of private boats that just inundated the landing site. And it was, I was watching that, and at first I go, I have no idea, who are all these boats? And then, you know, what are they up to? And then sure enough, they were revealed that they were just private folks who were watching the NASA broadcast and the SpaceX broadcast that was actually showing the exact location and timing of the splashdown with GPS location, and they could just tap into that and get exactly the place where Dragon was splashing down. So this was actually something that they weren't expecting. And NASA administrator mentioned that this is something for future splashdowns. They're going to really have to step up, because it's actually quite dangerous to have this. There could be poisonous gas associated, fuel leaks associated with the spacecraft during splashdown. Nitrous trioxide is a primary one. And this could be of danger to everyone around the spacecraft. And so even, you know, and it was interesting, because I was reading that Coast Guard was saying that, you know, they didn't even have jurisdiction. This was in international waters. And this is something they're going to have to find out. How are they going to make sure that they keep a perimeter, a safe perimeter around the splash zone for future missions? And they don't have a lot to wait here, because already the next mission is slated for sometime mid or late September.
Well, I guess one of the things they'll have to decide is whether or not to give out coordinates like they did last time. I guess that's the easiest way to avoid it. Very quickly, one of the things, now that we're looking back at this particular mission, I'm reminded of when I had the opportunity to talk to Alan Bean from the second Apollo moon flight or moon mission. And he said that, you know, all Neil Armstrong and that crew had to do was get there and get back, and that was a success. The real work began when other crews went to the moon and did experiments. So basically, we're in the same situation here. Mm-hmm. Doug and Bob, all they had to do was get there and get back, and now the real work begins. So what exactly is the real work for SpaceX and future flights?
Well, right, exactly. So, you know, what NASA really hopes is to be a customer of SpaceX, you know, and they want to be one of many customers in basically something that they're calling a robust commercial marketplace that basically creates a taxi service, a reliable taxi service to and from low Earth orbit and the International Space Station. So this was basically a shakedown flight. This was their second demonstration of the Dragon crew vehicle. This was the first and only demo with humans. Now the next one is actually the first crew flight, the regular crew flight. So once they all check out, and over the next couple of weeks, they're going to be making sure that, you know, looking over what went on with this flight, this is going to be a springboard to do a lot more harder things, particularly going to the moon. That is going to be where, you know, the Artemis program that NASA has, basically the follow-up to the Apollo program in the 60s, That's where we want to go, is going back to the moon and then, of course, moving on to Mars. So these technological innovations that we're seeing with SpaceX, with rockets that are reusable, Dragon capsule, this capsule that takes humans to space, will be outfitted to go into deep space as well on even bigger rocket boosters. So it's you know, we're talking about the next 4 years getting onto the moon, and then perhaps another 4 to 6 years to get onto Mars.
I know they did a lot of tests and did a lot of experiments while they were up there to talk about and deal with future flights. For instance, I know they were eating and drinking and changing in the capsule. And they also brought the other astronauts who were at the space station in the capsule with them, so that there were more people, because in the future, they're going to be larger crews on that.
Well, yeah, that's right. And Dragon is outfitted with four seats. So definitely it'll be a lot more crowded, and they're going to have to accommodate, you know, being able to do docking maneuvers, you know, opening the hatch and packing all the supplies in with a full, you know, slate of astronauts on board. So it's going to get, the complexity will increase enormously over the next couple of years as more astronauts and more flights occur.
Very quickly, in a sentence, where does this put Boeing?
Well, that's a good question. They are behind. NASA's really looking very closely with a hawkish eye on Boeing. They've come up with a lot of problems back in December with their last test flight. They really have to have a total shakedown of everything. They're behind the game now.
Okay.
So we'll see.
And we're running out of time, but I just want to bring up the NASA Mars rover. The thing that's very interesting about the launch that took place from Cape Canaveral is the fact that one of the things on board is a helicopter?
That's right. That's right. This is the first time ever that we're going to have a helicopter on another planet. And it's like a souped up, you know, on steroids type of drone type of helicopter. It's purely a technology demonstration. Its name is Ingenuity. And it really, the aim here is to prove that you can have a flying vehicle operate in Mars's atmosphere, which is really 1/100th as thick as Earth's. And it weighs less than 2 kilograms, and it's underbelly of the rover. And so once it finds a suitable location, they're going to conduct all these amazing flying experiments. So I can hardly wait to see the camera footage coming from this helicopter technology.
And one of the things that's interesting about this is that they're hoping to eventually collect rocks and bring them back to Earth?
That's right. So a big part of this mission is to find evidence of past life on Mars. We think Mars was very Earth-like in its distant past. And we're landing in an area that used to be a river delta, which was basically inundated with water billions of years ago. So we think if there's any evidence of past life, this is the perfect place. And we'll be collecting rock samples and stowing them on board the rover for a future mission, maybe in the next 4 to 6 years, that will be launched. And we'll pick up these samples from this rover and then bring it back to Earth to study in laboratories here.
And in the 1 minute we have left, weren't there recent pictures that stated that parts of Mars looked like early Canada?
It's very possible. I mean, Mars is a very barren, dry, cold desert place, and some of parts of Earth, particularly here in Canada, is very Mars-like. And in fact, a lot of mission scientists, and particularly at the Canadian Space Agency, they actually go to Mars for training, all kinds of using technology and working.
They go to Mars for training?
No, they go to northern parts of Canada for training.
Okay.
Which is very Mars-like.
Very Mars-like. Yeah, well, there you go. Fascinating as always, sir. Thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy. and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0573, and you'll find links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you before we get to the idiot of the day. And that story is, in Izmir, Turkey, 29-year-old paragliding instructor Hasan Kaval took couch surfing to a whole new level when he rigged a red leather couch, lamp, and TV to a parachute harness and launched himself from a cliff at Babadag Air Sports and Recreation Center. Kaval videotaped himself July 2nd as he sailed over a beach on the couch, pulling out snacks and drinks and kicking off his shoes to put on slippers as he settled in to watch cartoons. Kaval's rig landed safely and he did not miss any of his shows. I will put a link in on the Stuff File page on Facebook so you can actually see this. It's rather interesting. You know, this takes battling going stir crazy because of COVID literally to a whole new level. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
32-year-old Edward Thomas Shinzing was charged July 28th with arson for allegedly setting fires inside the Justice Center in Portland, Oregon on May 29th, beginning 2 months of protest in that city. We should note that Shinzing is not exactly a common name. It's spelled S-C-H-I-N-Z-I-N-G. I bring up his name because the shirtless Shinzing stood out among about 30 people who broke into the building at around 11 p.m., vandalizing offices and setting fires, because of the large tattoo of his last name clearly visible across his shoulders on surveillance images, basically turning Shinzing into a human sports jersey. Shinzing, who was on probation at the time for domestic violence assault, is being held at the very same Justice Center. Oh, that's karma. Now, why, oh why, when you know federal buildings are bound to have several surveillance cameras, would you set fire and trash said building shirtless when your name is tattooed in giant gothic font across your back? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0573. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0573. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.